Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds.
It's the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. I'm your host, Walt Thiessen, here with co-host Bill Westmiller. Today is Thursday, November 7, 2013. And here are some of the headlines we'll be looking at today. It turns out that the UK's spy chiefs, they're about as verbal as the U.S. spy chiefs now. They've been kind of quiet up until now because it's all been NSA and CIA and so forth telling us about how Edward Snowden's revelations have done terrible damage to U.S. Spying interests abroad. Now the U.K. is joining in. They made an appearance before Parliament basically saying the same thing. We're also taking a look at news from the European Union, where the central bank made what the New York Times called a surprise rate cut. We'll take a look at the GDP reports that came out from the government and how the numbers that came out of that report may be overstating things. In fact, we're also going to take a look at a question of whether or not the GDP may actually be reflecting, dare I say it, reductions in federal spending. We'll actually see if that's really true. But we're going to start off the hour with news that actually came from NBC News. This is what they're claiming as an exclusive. They issued it on their website about 15 minutes ago. Here's the headline. It says, exclusive, Obama personally apologizes for Americans losing health coverage. This is by Chuck Todd. I'll read a few paragraphs from it. He says, President Obama said Thursday that he is sorry that some Americans are losing their current health insurance plans as a result of the Affordable Care Act, despite his promise that no one would have to give up a health plan they liked. Quote, I am sorry that they are finding themselves in this situation based on assurances they got from me, unquote, he told NBC News in an exclusive interview at the White House. Quote, we've got to work hard to make sure that they know we hear them, and we are going to do everything we can to deal with folks who find themselves in a tough position as a consequence of this, unquote. Now, Bill, I'm one of those people who was notified by my insurance carrier that my insurance ends next year, and I guess I have one question. Why is it that I feel once again that I'm being set up?
Well, because you are.
I knew there was a good reason.
Well, it's fascinating that Obama tried for a week to lie about what he'd said until they came up with 39 different video clips of him saying exactly what he'd said about people not losing their policies. So I guess lying about what he'd said wasn't working so well, so he decided to apologize and we'll do whatever we can.
It reminds me of a line from the old West Wing TV show in which Toby, one of the lead advisors in the show, is asked whether or not this particular person who is going to appear in one of their Q&A sessions, Republican apparently, whether he was a little bit crazy. He says, no, he's not crazy, no, a little bit, no.
Yeah, and Obama's saying that he's going to do everything he can. Of course, totally contrary to the provisions of the law, Obama postponed the employer mandate for a year. Of course, he's not going to go so far to correct this problem as to postpone the individual mandate for a year. He's already postponed for 6 weeks, and frankly, I doubt that there is going to be any changes in the law because Obama lied to us about what was in the law in the first place.
Oh, you mean I'm not actually going to see any real change? Oh. I'm just deflated.
You can hope that they'll change it, but you won't actually see any change.
But you promised change in two straight election cycles.
I've come up with a new acronym for the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare Less. Careless about what he said, careless about the website design, careless about the implementation, careless about the law. So I think it's inappropriate.
And as long as the law stays in place, he's fine. He can care less.
Well, as long as he can decide whenever he wants what the law says and enforce it the way he wants. See, the original statement he made wasn't a lie. It was just a typo. What he meant to say was, if I like your policy, you can keep it. Period.
Ah, of course.
Just one minor typo.
You see, it's all just, it's the copywriters. You can't trust copywriters. That's all there is to it. Oh, dear. Well, we also had some interesting double talk coming out of the European Union as the central bankers. According to the New York Times, this was a surprise, but other media outlets were a little bit more subdued about it. But they cut the interest rates in Europe again under a threat of deflation. Once again, deflation facing Europe. This is a major catastrophe, of course, that we must avoid at all costs. So turn on the spigots even bigger and even wider than they have been up until now. I guess the one question, the one thought that comes to my mind is, when you're filling a giant vat with a tap that is approximately 4 inches in diameter, so that water is pouring out at a rate of about 500 gallons a second, and that's the equivalent of how much money is being printed, what does it mean when you actually want to expand that?
Well, you know, what's behind this European Central Bank cut is that they sat down and they said, wait a second, Bernanke is totally blowing away the inflation. They're inflating much faster than we are, so we've got to inflate a whole lot more just to keep even with the inflation in the U.S. So they cut their rate from 0.5 to 0.25% as their central bank loan rate. And they will do, quote, whatever it takes to preserve the euro status. No, an even funnier part of this particular story about the central bank was that they said they wanted to head off what some economists fear would be a long period of stagnation like the one that has affected Japan. Well, the historic fact is that Japan did so much quantitative easing over the past 10 years that their economy was basically stagnant for a whole 10-year period. They were doing quantitative easing long before Bernanke even thought about doing it.
Right. Yeah, and what's really remarkable is that when Bernanke first started doing his QE, there were critics, mainly from the Austrian school, who were basically saying, look, there's nothing new here. This is what the Japanese had been doing throughout the 1990s, and it didn't do them any good. And so what did Bernanke do? He did it anyway, and now the European Union are saying they want to avoid Japan's fate by doing the same thing.
Yeah.
Got to love
the
logic.
You can't ever accuse these central banks of using logic.
But it's so much fun to try.
Yeah. Well, of course, the bank, central bank, was reacting to a sudden drop in Eurozone inflation, which fell to an annual rate of 0.7% in October. In other words, it's only inflating 0.7% in October, which is 12% annually, or roughly 12%. So it's not inflating enough. They have to inflate it more. So they have to get up to their standard rate, which is 2%. So it's just a crazy way to do monetary policy.
I love Mario Draghi, who's the president of the ECB. I loved his comment about what it is that the ECB is doing in trying to respond to this threat of sustained fall prices, sustained deflation, the specter of deflation. You know, they have these really nicely, emotionally laden words. It's very effective.
But it would be really disastrous if the price of goods on the market went down.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, that can't happen. I mean,
absolutely, because we should never make stuff affordable.
But because because economic growth is only what the Fed prints, and the more it prints, the more growth you have. That's how it works.
That's right.
No.
Well, anyway, getting to Draghi's comment, here's what he said. He said, if we mean by deflation a self-fulfilling fall in prices across a very large category of goods and across a very significant number of countries, we don't see that. I don't think it is similar to Japan.
Yeah.
What?
I think they just sit down and make up these stories. You know, they don't actually read the history and find out what Japan was doing and what the consequences were. They just fabricate a story that sounds good.
They don't even fabricate very well. I mean, consider the phrase from that quote, across a very significant number of countries. How many countries does he think Japan is?
Well, you have to count in Zambia.
I didn't share it.
And Argentina, you know, they only had an inflation rate of 23%.
Did somebody put in a DMZ and we didn't hear about it? Is that what happened? Good grief. I mean, look, if you're going to make stuff up, at least make it, you know, plausible.
Well, the law itself is implausible. The whole law setting up the Fed said that they had to balance off interest rates and job creation. As though the level of interest rates, however artificial it is, had anything whatever to do with job creation. There's no correlation. It's not a balance. It's just two subtle, totally distinct economic operations. You can have low interest rates and high unemployment, which is what Carter got.
So you have to find some way to justify it, you know. I was having a conversation about, I mean, we got to get to the other news articles because obviously we only have an hour here and we used up about a quarter of it. But I was in a discussion online with a guy who's, it was actually at the Nolan Chart site. This guy is basically, he's pretty much a statist, I would say, and very much in line with Keynesian economic theory and so forth. And I published an article in which I was calling to question whether or not Rand Paul really understands monetary policy as well as his dad does. Well, in the comments section, it's ranged into this long-ranging discussion that goes far beyond Rand Paul and the Fed and goes into the theory of Keynesian economics and all this other stuff. It just goes on and on and on. One of the things that he was trying to claim is that it's not like we've always had. I made a point that there's never been a government that didn't expand the money supply, that all governments throughout history have always done that. And he says, well, that's not true, because both the European Union and Volcker here in the U.S. both were fiscally and monetarily very tight. Their monetary policy was extremely tight. And I said, well, I agree that they were perhaps tighter than some, but look at the record. The money supply increased. You can call it tight if you want to, but it's still increased, and it increased consistently every single year.
Yeah, I mean, you look at the charts. No matter what the story or the fable is that the Fed is telling, they actually believe that there is no economic growth without their injection of more fiat currency into the system. That's what they actually believe.
Absolutely. Yeah, and which is crazy, especially when you look at the history. In fact, that's what this guy was arguing. He was basically saying you have to have slow monetary growth in order to drive the most optimum economic growth. And I responded to him, look at the St. Louis Fed's table. There's a text file you can get that shows the monetary base from 1918 to the present. And it's the most consistent annual growth you've ever seen. I mean, it literally must have been planned because it is so consistent, which is exactly what these people who claim that you have to have a low rate of monetary growth, that's exactly what they claim you have to do, because it has to match, depending on which viewpoint they're taking, either the growth of the population or the growth of the economy. And, of course, it's kind of like two Keynesian schools on that, neither of which is accurate, but they do have kind of like their little split there. But you look at the actual numbers, and that's exactly what they've done. And what have we had? Well, we've had basically a century of economic catastrophe. One major Great Depression, another major depression that's not so-called in the last 5 years. I think something – I did a count one time, something like 20 different recessions and crises during that same period of time.
Yeah.
Approximately one-third of the entire century, the economy was in a downturn. We had exactly what they prescribed, and look at the results.
Yeah, you had Carter's stagflation, the dot-com boom.
Yep.
You had the housing boom. Those were all artificially created bubbles.
Everything in order.
Now the Fed is creating another artificial bubble, and this time it's in the stock market. And there are people worried about that.
And in fact, maybe this is the time to put a plug in. We'll also put a plug at the end of the show, but we have a special guest coming next week who is going to have a lot to say on this subject. In fact, he wrote the book. G. Edward Griffin, the author of The Creature from Jekyll Island and a number of other publications and movie documentaries, is going to be joining us for an hour. We had him on the show about three and a half years ago, something like that. He's a fascinating guest. And he's going to have some really interesting stuff to say, I'm sure, as he always does, about this very topic, the topic of monetary expansion and the Fed and all the wonderful ways that it basically ruins our lives.
The occasion is that next month is the 100th anniversary of the Fed. December 23rd, 1913, was when the Federal Reserve Law was passed.
It was an early Christmas present.
There you go. But the topic that that caught my attention when I suggested Griffin was that he is running an organization called Freedom Force.
Right.
We can discuss that. But he added a new provision in there, into his creed, stating that rather than trying to eliminate the fiat currency system, we are in favor of competing currencies.
Mm.
Which I thought was a rather intriguing topic for discussion.
That isn't really something that he covered in his magnum opus, Creature from Jekyll Island. He kind of evaded that topic. So it's interesting that he came out in favor of that, and I'm glad he did.
Well, we'll talk to him about next week.
Absolutely. It's going to be a good show. You won't want to miss it. Absolutely. Write down your calendar. Other news going on, the NSA, UK spy chief, we kind of touched on the fact that they're, you know, doing the same thing they've always done. But the thing that caught my attention was how they were trying to claim that Snowden, once again, trying to claim that Snowden undermined operations with Al-Qaeda, basically claiming that Al-Qaeda now knows all the different ways that we're spying on them. And I find that fascinating for a couple of reasons. Well, I mean, we've exploited that myth here a few times on the show. But I guess perhaps the most fascinating part from my point of view is that they keep telling the same story, both the intelligence community here in the U.S. and now the intelligence community in the U.K., spouting the line that all of what that Snowden has released has been news to Al-Qaeda. And it's simply not true.
Yeah.
Here's the question I have for you, Bill. Do you think that people are actually buying into that propagandist myth?
I don't think so. Not as much as they did. I mean, even though there have been a lot of revelations and Snowden's released a lot of documents and so on, the fable that the NSA and the Defense Department wanted to purvey was that all of their operations had to be kept absolutely secret so that Al-Qaeda would never find out about them. But what Snowden's documents reveal was that they weren't spying on Al-Qaeda. They were spying on American citizens.
Right.
They were collecting all this data, you know, bulk case stacks or whatever of data from ordinary Americans. And they were doing these searches with two or three hops, you know, going through pizza stores and heaven knows what. What's intriguing is that they are still asserting that Snowden's revelations benefited Al-Qaeda, when in fact what happened was they damaged the storyline of the NSA, that this was to hide things from Al-Qaeda. It was to hide things from voters. It was to hide things from ordinary citizens whose phones were being, you know, transactions were being recorded for decades. And internet connections and everything else under the sun. I mean, they weren't hiding it from Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda knew damn well exactly what they were tapping, and that's why they used couriers instead of telephones. And they've been doing that for two decades.
And the other part of the statement that these three leaders of the intelligence community in Great Britain had said, on the one hand, they said that the documents that Snowden put out basically put secret operations at risk and were being, quote, lapped up, unquote, by Al-Qaeda, which we know is insane. But at the same time, they said that the same head said that Snowden's disclosures about mass surveillance had prompted them to consider being more open about what they do. Now, we know, you and I know, that's just a bunch of BS that they're trying to make themselves look like. They're trying to re-spin their story. But my goodness, I mean, there's a direct contradiction in that. And I guess that's what prompted my question. I mean, surely there must be some intelligent people somewhere in the major media who say, wait a minute.
If the consequences of Snowden's revelation was that the security agents had to be more open about what they do, that is a good thing, not a bad thing.
I just don't believe it. I think it's just more for public consumption BS.
Yeah, well, I mean, they had no choice as to what they're open about because Snowden's revealed practically everything they're doing anyway. So there isn't anything to be open about. What they're doing at Congress, though, is interesting because the chief apologists for the NSA, of course, run the security and the intelligence and judiciary committees. So they're trying to rewrite law to authorize everything the NSA has been doing, with a few reports, you know, bouncing around here and there within the executive branch. So there is no political response that government is willing to open up more about what they do. It's being pushed on them by these Snowden revelations. It's not a policy choice at all. They have no choice about being more open because Snowden's revealing everything they're doing.
It's true, yeah. And in fact, the Reuters report that I looked at about this particular story, it included the fact that this was the first time ever that the intelligence chiefs had appeared in a parliamentary inquiry as a public forum. It had always been done behind closed doors before now. So, I mean, they're all by itself. That alone shows that Snowden's revelations have had some very positive effects, because now for the first time, they actually had a public hearing. Was anything significant revealed? Absolutely not. But, hey, it's a step in the right direction.
Well, the storyline has always been that all of the NSA policies have been subject to scrutiny and close oversight by Congress and by the courts and so on and so forth. And what Snowden's revelations of, beyond what the NSA is doing, revealed was that there was no oversight. The FISA court that supposedly overlooked all of these NSA orders did everything the NSA wanted it to do and occasionally quibbled about methods and procedures. Occasionally said, hey, you're lying to us, tell us the truth now. But there was no oversight. They never, ever looked at any warrant or any kind of a command to look into a terrorist connection. It was broad general warrants to take everybody's information on all domestic calls and local calls from every telecom provider in the country. So it's just it's totally incongruous that they're ever going to do anything about it.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's the reality.
However, Obama did do something about it. Remember, we were talking last week about the fact that the NSA was scooping up all kinds of financial and economic information from all around the world.
Yeah.
And guess what? Obama actually admitted it. He announced that he had ordered the National Security to stop eavesdropping on that terrible terrorist organization, the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. In other words, he admitted that the NSA had been spying on the IMF and the World Bank for years. And now he's issued an order to halt those practices. Because I assume that he realized that sooner or later that was going to come out from one Snowden document or another.
Except they'll probably come out later on, or his aides will come out later on and say, well, we never actually admitted that the spying had gone on in the first place. It was just sort of a prophylactic thing. We were trying to make sure that, you know, they never did, just in case they ever decided to.
Well, that's not the way the story reads it. They're going to stop doing this. It says the actual statement was that the NSA has been ordered to stop eavesdropping, which is an admission that they have.
They'll probably stick to that story until, you know, if it ever becomes a hot story so that everybody's talking about it, then they'll spin it. But for the moment, they'll let that one go.
Yeah, right.
The stock market continues to, boom, I guess, sort of. It's kind of like the stock market seems to be, has for quite some time been disconnected from the rest of the economy, and it seems even more so since 2008. But you found an interesting piece on whether or not the stock market is actually a bubble or perhaps even a Fed boom. Tell us the details of what you found.
The bottom line is that with the quantitative easing, when they reduce the interest rate at the Fed, that has with it various caveats about what banks can lend and who can qualify for the money. And what it effectively did was it cut out everybody except the major corporations who are on the stock market. So what the corporations did was they borrowed money from the Fed, they rebought their own stock, and as a consequence, the value of the stock goes up. Now, the incongruous thing that's happening is that whenever there's an indication that GDP is falling, that causes the stock market to boom. Why is that? Psychological, because if the GDP is falling, then the Fed is going to continue with their easy money policies. If unemployment goes up, then the stock market is happy that unemployment is going up because that means the Fed is not going to stop its quantitative easing. So there's not going to be any tapering, and the big corporations can borrow all this money, and they're not investing it in jobs. They're not investing in new equipment. They're investing it in pumping up the value of their stock by taking portions of their stock off the market. So it's an intriguing effect that all of this quantitative easing, as soon as it switches or if they try to taper it off, the stock market is going to crash because it's a big bubble. It's the whole thing is driven entirely by the availability of free money from the Fed.
Well, we're coming up on break time. Let's take the break, and then after the break, let's take a look at the question of what will happen with the stock market, because it turns out we have GDP numbers this week, and those GDP numbers, well, you'll just have to wait and find out exactly what they say. This is the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, here on the Progressive Radio Network, and we will be right back. Welcome back to the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. Walton Bill here on this Thursday, November 7th. We were talking before the break about the peculiarity of the stock market. And is it a bubble? Is it a boom? Or is it just insanity? Actually, it's all three all wrapped up to one. But as Bill was pointing out before the break, it all kind of ties into what the stock market investors think is happening with the GDP, and it's kind of a perverse relationship that goes on there. Well, the GDP numbers came out this week, and according from Reuters, GDP grew at a 2.8% annual rate for the third quarter. That's the quickest pace of the year after expanding at 2.5% in the second quarter, according to the Commerce Department. They said that inventories, however, account for a hefty 0.8 percentage points of the advance made in the third quarter. So if we go back to the theory you were talking about, Bill, I guess what we should presume then is if GDP shows this unexpected surge of 2.8%, which I don't really buy into, but because I don't believe in the GDP. But for those who do believe it, and apparently a lot of stock market investors do, I guess this means that we should be signaling a stock market fall or perhaps a crash. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, they covered up the number. I mean, they said that it was a 2.8% rate in the third quarter, but 0.8% was just restocking inventories. It wasn't sales. So the actual GDP only grew at 2%, which was the lowest it's been in the past year. So you know, understand what I'm saying? In other words, the gross domestic product isn't just counting the amount of production, sales, transactions, economic transactions in the economy. It's counting purchases to restock inventory, and not purchases, but restocking inventory. They also count GDP as in the GDP numbers, the amount of taxes collected, the amount of U.S. government spending that's been done. So like half of the GDP is government. It's not private enterprise at all. So it's a peculiar mess to totally misrepresents. It totally misrepresents what the economy is actually doing that benefits consumers or people, human beings. It measures as much what the government is doing, what's benefiting the government, more than at least half of the increase in GDP is increase in government. So it's a deceptive number to begin with, but even these quarterly numbers is a deception because the GDP growth wasn't the increase in sales or transactions or consumer amounts. In fact, the same article pointed out that domestic demand, which is consumer demand, is only growing at a 1.7 rate, which is 0.3% lower than the GDP that they're calculating. So, but it encourages the stock market because that means that because the rate is small, they can continue, the Fed can continue to pump this $85 billion into the economy every single month. And as long as that's happening, the stock market bubble is going to be fine. As soon as it stops happening or is reduced, the stock market's in for big trouble.
So I guess we can predict that the stock market is going to fall, but it's also going to rise and vice versa.
You're sounding like a politician.
I just called the way I see him.
Yeah, no, who knows? I mean, there really is no limit until they get up into the percentage of inflation that they're doing in the monetary sense. Until it hits a number that is really exorbitant, and people recognize that it just totally blowing away the economy, it's. The stock market bubble will probably continue for another year or two. So it's hard to predict when the bubble is going to burst.
Yeah, that's the tricky thing about bubbles, because they maintain a certain degree of inflation, a certain degree of air inside them, so to speak. And at some point, the structural integrity of the bubble starts to fall apart. But you never actually see it happen until after it happens.
Right.
I mean, we don't get to see the little hole opening up in the bubble before the bubble pops. We just see the pop.
Well, and you don't get to see the distortions in the market. For example, I mean, 2% annual GDP growth rate is fine. I mean, that's good as far as the Fed is concerned. They shouldn't be doing any quantitative easing at all. But what they don't explain in this GDP number is that all of that growth is focused. It's focused specifically on large corporations and publicly held corporations that are able to use all of that Fed money to pump up the GDP, and that's what's happening.
So we feel so much better and so much safer, which is a good thing. But, yeah, the thing that I guess I keep focusing on here is just how crazy GDP is, and you did an admirable job of showing how crazy it is. I'd just like to throw in one more little piece. This comes directly from the report that comes from the Commerce Department, because they have their own press release that basically says the same thing that the news agencies say, because news agencies don't actually report any news that they dug up. They just report what the government tells them. But buried in that government report was a rather interesting line. Let's see if I can find it here quickly. Of course, I probably won't be able to because I'm talking while I do it. But, oh, yeah, here we go. The acceleration in real GDP growth in the third quarter primarily reflected a deceleration in imports and accelerations in private inventory investment and in state and local government spending that were partly offset by decelerations in exports in non-residential fixed investment and in PCE. Now, if you haven't totally had your eyes spin back into your head, you're doing very well. Now, not find the exact thing that I was looking for here, though, because that doesn't include the line I was looking for. But basically, in this report, somewhere down here, oh, here we go. Real federal government consumption expenditures and gross investment decreased 1.7% in the third quarter, compared with a decrease of 1.6% in the second quarter. And then national defense decreased by 0.7% compared to 0.6%. Non-defense decreased 3.3% compared with a decrease of 3.1%. And real state and local government consumption increased 1.5%. This is part of an overall storyline that continues to come out of the Office of Management and Budget, which is that government spending keeps decreasing, has been decreasing over the last couple of years. In fact, I sent you a link on this. I think there was a PolitiFact story from about a month ago about a Republican House representative named Dennis Ross, who at that time was calling for an end to the government shutdown because he was saying that, according to the Office of Management and Budget, we've been successfully reining in government spending to the tune of 2 years straight of reductions in government spending. And I just find all this information to be, well, first of all, not terribly believable, but second of all, fascinating, because it just kind of adds into the weave of all this misdirection that they tie into the GDP number and the importance they place on it. I was kind of curious to see what your take on the whole thing was, but it's amazing how you can take these huge numbers and just weave them into almost any storyline you want, depending on, you know, what position you want to take.
Yeah. Well, we don't want to get too much into the analyzing individual numbers, but the numbers they're talking about when they're talking about federal outlays, first of all, a large proportion of it is a reduction in defense expenses because we're no longer fighting the Iraq War, and there's something of a drawdown as far as Afghanistan is concerned. We haven't talked about Afghanistan in a long time, but there's an ongoing plan, theoretically. At the end of 2014, we're going to be out of Afghanistan. So those things have an effect on federal spending. But the other thing is when they release these numbers, they're almost always inflation-adjusted numbers. So even though the amount of spending goes up in nominal terms, the percentage, when it's offset by this inflation factor, it looks like the spending is going down. And when you see charts and so on, what they show is not the amount of spending, nor even the inflation-adjusted spending. What they show is percentage of GDP. So when they do it as a percentage of GDP, as long as the economy is growing, spending as a percentage of GDP by the federal government is maintaining constant, except for periods during Bush's administration, but we'll ignore that for a moment.
So
all the numbers are gamed, you know, just gamed left and right and front and back just to give the impression that they're doing the right thing.
And what makes it particularly confusing, I mean, you very eloquently pointed out that these are all inflation-adjusted numbers, but the inflation numbers that they're using are themselves inaccurate. So they take inaccurate inflation numbers to adjust the numbers to make them look like they're going down when they're really going up, except that's only in nominal terms because of the fact that they're actually doing a much greater inflation. And when you take the much greater inflation into account and try to apply that, what you really find is that the economy is and continues to be and has been in a gigantic recession.
Yeah, well, that's true. If you look at any of the charts, this is the longest, lowest depression we've had since the Great Depression.
Yeah.
There's no two ways about it. I'm going to do a little bit of research because there's another aspect of this that I'm not sure about, and it isn't something that hits the news stories. For example, we're familiar with the quantitative easing. Well, that's a very specific program of the Fed, and what it entails is buying $40 billion worth of U.S. Treasuries, so they keep the rate on the Treasury bonds low so the government can borrow more and more and more money and not have to pay more for interest. The other $45 billion is buying shares in Fannie and Freddie Mac, which is still trying to cure the housing bubble that they created over the past decade. So they're taking on additional debt through the mortgage companies, which is still not solving the problem of the housing market. But here's something that's not mentioned at all. Totally separate from that program, they have a standard, what they call an open market committee, and mm-hmm. they decide how much money they're going to print. This is totally separate from the $85 billion that they're printing and spending on those two things. They actually print additional money that they make available to all the Federal Reserve banks and pump into the economy. So I'm not sure whether that, the open market window is what it's called, whether that is increasing simultaneously with this $85 billion in U.S. Treasury purchases and Fannie Mae purchases. It would be interesting to do a little research and see how much they're pumping into the general economy, the general banking system.
Yeah, it would be interesting if you do that research. Do share it with us, because I'm sure there's some interesting stuff out of there.
Or I'll keep it secret.
The thing that we should point out, of course, is when you're talking about printing money, you're not talking about the monetary base. You're talking about the expansionary power of the Fed. The monetary base is what that is built on, but that's not the sum whole of all parts. I mean, the U.S. Treasury does the actual printing of the bills, for instance, and the actual currency that is true currency that's basically increasing at the same rate it always has. But you're talking about monetary expansion through not the power of the printing press, but through the power of the electronic pen. That's different
yeah.
kind of printing.
Yeah.
So, okay, well, we've touched on enough of that to depress everybody, because that's part of our job here at the Freedom News Hour.
To depress everyone.
we're good at it, you know. little quick note about J.P. Morgan and mortgages, this is something that was a story from a few weeks back. We didn't really touch on it. It's been kind of sitting on the table. Why don't you just clean it up for us, because it's been just kind of hanging there, and we didn't really have any place to put it in before, and this seems as good a place as any.
Yeah, this is a little bit of insider kind of news. Recall that J.P. Morgan was one of those that packaged the bad loans and did these CDOs and stuff like that. Well, the feds have come down on them because J.P. Morgan supposedly misrepresented the value of these mortgages to their customers and so on. The amusing thing is that J.P. Morgan actually lost money. They lost like $20 billion selling these things.
Them out. Yeah.
Yeah, so they came to a settlement with the regulators to pay a $4 billion settlement amount for homeowner relief. Now, it actually isn't homeowner relief. $4 billion is going to the people who were actually buying these CDOs. So, mm-hmm. again, it's still a bailout that's going on behind the scenes. And J.P. Morgan is being persecuted for losing money. They lost money. J.P. Morgan lost money. Some of their investors lost money. So they're going to pull out a few percentage points of their profits for the year and force them to reimburse the investors that supposedly were misrepresented.
But
misrepresentation.
Ultimately, the people who were really hurt, the people who were the homeowners who were basically misled by a crazy monetary-driven stock market and a monetary-driven real estate market into buying homes and going deeper into debt and so forth and so on until the whole thing fell apart. They shouldn't be bailed out. I mean, it should be the investors who are trying to profit from that. They're the ones who should be bailed out.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. No, there was actually a study done as to how much of the homeowner TARP funds, troubled asset relief monies, that went out, it's now, 3 years ago, 4 years ago? How much of it actually went to relieve consumers who had underwater loans that went underwater? And it was something like 1.2% of the total amount of money they spent actually went to homeowners to relieve them of mortgage obligations. So what they'd like to characterize it is we saved the economy by bailing out the investors who invested in these mortgages that never should have been issued in the first place.
Because they were duped, but the people who actually took out the mortgages weren't.
Right.
I'm glad we got that straight.
We got
okay. Well, we got about, 8 minutes left, and six of those minutes I want to spend on Obamacare because, first of all, the president very kindly apologized to me and 5% of the population who are going to have our health insurance canceled sometime after the first of the year. And I took his heartfelt apology and put it exactly where it belonged. But besides that, there have been a few other pieces of not so much news, but stories that have cropped up, particularly during the debacle of the healthcare.gov website and all the fallout from that. One of them was a little piece that tied into Mitt Romney. I presume it tied into the healthcare, the universal healthcare he put in when he was governor of Massachusetts. I didn't actually get to read the story, but fill us in on the details on that one.
Well, the bottom line, you remember from the presidential campaign that Romney had Romney Care. And
right.
That Obama said, well, you know, Obamacare is just, you know, a takeoff on Romney Care. Well, the interesting thing is that Romney is saying that the problem with Obamacare is that it's a one-size-fits-all plan that is being imposed on everybody. Of course, that's totally incongruous because his program, Romney Care in Massachusetts, was imposed a one-size-fit-all plan on everybody in Massachusetts. So it's extremely confusing what Romney is trying to say, saying the one-size-fits-all plan is good if we impose it on one state, but if you impose it on more states, it's bad. So it's very peculiar. But the other aspect, too...
It's another. Almost impossible to believe that he actually got defeated in his run for president with a line like that.
The other side, too, is that there's been a lot of research done on Romney Care. And even though it's portrayed as a fantastic success, the number of people who were uninsured before they put it into effect is the same percentage as it is today. It actually only... increased the rate of people covered by medical insurance by something like 0.20%. But the other aspect that nobody looks at is whether or not it has actually improved medical care. I mean, totally set aside the idea of having insurance as being the solution to the problem. The fact is that the analysis of hospital and doctor treatments has the efficiency of the medical system has fallen in Massachusetts at a rate that is faster than any other state in the union. That is, the number of readmissions and hospital surgeries, the number of revisits that are required for treatment of simple ailments by doctors, the whole medical care, not medical care insurance, but the whole medical care system in Massachusetts has been deteriorating ever since Romney Care was put into place. So if that's the template for Obamacare, you can expect to see over the next few years the entire nation falling in terms of the efficiency of actual medical care of people who are ill or injured. So it's interesting.
Yeah, I qualified that as not really news, but maybe it is news in a sense because – correct me if I'm wrong, I don't really recall any discussion since Obamacare was being debated and passed into law without anybody reading the bill because we had to find out what it was after we passed it into law. I remember anyone talking about what happens to the quality of medical care after Obamacare gets passed. So maybe this is news in a sense.
Well, I think it is because we talk about insurance as a solution to all problems. It's not. It's the quality of the medical care and the motives and decisions that are made by doctors in terms of what people need in order to treat an illness. Now, theoretically, Obamacare has this panel that's supposed to review all the procedures for outcome, effect, and so on and so forth, which hasn't gone into effect yet, and it won't for another year or so. But the additional sidelight was that the successor to Romney, Governor Deval Patrick, said that the RomneyCare system took 2 years to get their website operating. And now they have 90% of their residents with primary care. 90%, okay? Before RomneyCare was implemented, it was 92%, okay? Now, he says that the RomneyCare program and the Obamacare program are both value statements, hoping to do a lot of good for a lot of people. In other words, mm-hmm. they're not economic proposals. They are value statements. In other words, political positions.
Sure. And I think that's a very fair description of what they are. I think that's precisely what they are, because they certainly don't make any sense economically. They certainly don't make any sense from a healthcare perspective.
Right.
But it's difficult to find any way that they make sense other than as an emotional political appeal.
Well, it's philosophical, too, because you have to understand that the key issue philosophically for Obama and even for the Romney group was that people have a right to free medical care, and that the original proposal that to some degree Obamacare implements through Medicaid is a one-payer system, where the government pays for all medical insurance, decides what medical procedures are going to be conducted, decides how money is going to be distributed, decides who's going to provide the medical care. So it's philosophically this idea that everybody has a right to medical care, medical insurance, and so on and so forth, is a philosophical, it's a political statement about what rights people have. Now, theoretically, everybody has a right to a loaf of bread. Theoretically, everybody has a right to have clothing that's, affordable. So you could take that whole philosophical principle all the way down the economic steps of the ladder, down to the simple point of the government has to decide, because they have the experts, what you do with your life, no matter what it is. How many times you flush the toilet, how big the toilet tank is. So all those things are... It's a philosophical, political statement, not an economically viable one.
And it's amazing how that political statement has evolved to the point where the word free, because you're right, it's been touted as people having a right to free medical care. Free has all these interesting price tags associated with it. And people keep buying into the idea that, medical care should be by right free. And it's just fascinating. At some
next
point,
week.
You think the reality is going to kick in and they're going to say, wait a minute, it's not free.
Next week, we'll talk about how the Fed does makes government appear to give
them free. Yeah, Edward Griffin's going to be joining us. You won't want to miss that one. We'll ask him, among other things, about how the Fed's playing into Obamacare. And Bill, it's been a pleasure as usual.
Hey,
we'll see you all next time here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. Goodbye, everybody. People gonna rise up, get their share. Poor people gonna rise up and take what's theirs.